You don't have to touch.
What if she was...
No one would have believed in the middle of the 20th century that human affairs were being watched keenly and closely by intelligences greater than man's. Yet, across the gulf of space on the planet Mars, intellects vast and cool and unsympathetic regarded our Earth with envious eyes.
They seem to murder everything that moves. This is Film Sack. Oh, sure.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Film Sack. This is Film Sack, mining the very depths of film entertainment for all mankind, episode 256. That's right, 256 color VGA card, 1998. That's right, or something like that. My name is Scott Johnson. Joining me today would be Brian, Don't Fire Till They Zap the Priest Dunaway.
Oh, hi. Pardon me, human. We are from Mars and exhausted from unscrewing the escape hatch on our spaceship, which looks nothing like a bomb. Ah, I see you humans are engaged in the age-old practice of body gyration directed by a caller. Very good. With this commonality, I think we could be friends. Wow, I am thirsty. Can I bother you for a bottle of refreshing soda pop? Yes, that is what we call it on Mars. Or you prefer the term cola? Well, hold up. What is that? Would I like a straw for my soda pop? Wait here. I have to get something for my bomb. Spaceship.
Well, that's pretty good.
Yeah, that's probably going to be the best impersonation of that noise we're going to hear today. Yeah.
Weird freaking sound. Nicely done. Also with us, Randy. That there alien head looks like a penis, Jordan.
Aloha. As the Martians approached Earth, they considered where to settle. They couldn't choose the poles with their freezing nights. They couldn't choose South America with its monkeys that howl. Australia was no good with its lack of Mexican food. And they could see that China was a place with too many yaks. No, the Martians had but one choice. California, where men are men and women are really scarce. Yep. How are they going to understand us? We'll talk in sign language. Everyone understands the white flag, right? Ow!
That was interesting.
Oh my gosh, dude. That's great.
I think a sugar sack in the car. I'll be right back.
By the way, new tourism slogan for Australia. Australia, where there's not enough Mexican food. That's right. Fantastic.
So true.
Finally,
is it true?
Yeah, it is true. Finally with us.
It's not a burrito.
We'll get some emails, I'm sure.
We don't even know what a burrito is.
Finally with us, Brian, if you think the aliens are slow and useless, you should see the people Ibit.
So, do you have a pocket compass? No? How about a turkey baster? You have a circular saw? Maybe a spigmometer? No? Fine. Let's go to that farm over there, woman. You can cook me a full breakfast.
What? I seriously could have just listened to the characters in this movie being all completely out in the country in 1953 for hours.
Yep. Right. Yeah, I could have too. That was the best part. Just the way people talked. Mm-hmm. The worst part was, and I cannot emphasize this enough about War of the Worlds 1953, aliens are just absolutely stupid. They just float. Nothing's fast. Everything is slow. There's no way you can't stop those things. You're standing around watching it barely move. It's
apparently the greatest generation couldn't stop those
I guess
things.
So, it, dude.
Is the impending monster of doom, is death, you can't stop it, is coming slowly, and no matter what you do, you can't escape.
I guess so, and I know there's all kind of metaphors for, you know, Cold War era, post-World War II stuff and everything, but the idea that all of the former soldiers who were just in the, you know, the world's greatest conflict, who are now in their 30s, you know, they're family men, they're out there in the vast farms of California somewhere. And they just are so blown away by, you know, they could stare down the barrel of 50,000 Japanese in the islands of the Pacific, but they just can't deal with this slow moving vacuum that's not going to hurt anybody if you just run up there and just kick it over.
I was really impressed that our hero is a pure scientist.
with a
Geiger counter in the back of his truck. Like,
Nosy cop. It's like, get out of my junk, nosy cop.
Yeah, nosy cop.
You got a warrant for that?
I was trying to think of the last time the lead and hero of an action film. Sorry, that phrase. I know it grates, right. But fine. Action film was, Neil deGrasse Tyson. I can't figure it.
Oh, that's very interesting. He was pretty, leading man, tough guy, whatever, with a pair of glasses on, which didn't stay on very long, I noticed.
Yeah, I loved his Gene Barry's little flirtatious thing he did with taking his glasses off and going, I don't need them for things I look up close at or something like that.
No, it was a straight come on. I use them to see things far away, and then he takes them off and looks at her. But I don't use them when I want to get a closer look.
Right. Yeah.
That's it. That's the stuff.
It's creepy.
The weird times that he would take them off. And like, it was obviously Caruso styled, right? Where it was like, I'm making a point. Rip off the glasses. Yeah.
And since you're only the only woman in the entire world.
Apparently. And you're hysterical.
Trope alert.
Yeah. Big time trope alert. Holy crap. And she was hysterical. Yes. Right. And her hair never moved.
No, and I was really expecting a slap moment when she was freaking out over the aliens.
Yeah, why didn't that happen?
Hysterical woman.
Why didn't that happen?
Yeah, it should have happened. Like, this is the era, this is the time, the sensibility. He should have slapped her to calm her down, because that's what people did back then. Yeah.
So while we're talking about the trope of Smurfette,
yeah,
can anybody think of another film where there was one woman as strongly as this, and from the moment you saw her, you knew, oh my gosh, that's going to be the only woman in this film, and she's going to act like that the whole time.
Last week, when we watched, what did we watch last week? I don't remember.
The submarine movie.
Voyage to the Bottom of the
Sea. Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea.
There were two women.
Yeah, but your question is, when we saw her, did we think she was going to be? And yes, I agree. Yeah. I thought she was too. I thought she was going to be it.
There was two women, but only one of them you knew was going to get to be the love interest. I mean,
it was exactly. She's too old. She's past her years. The only thing she's good for now is cooking.
That's right. She's over 31, and you may as well put her out to pasture. See,
the film that came to mind for me was Pacific Rim.
Yeah,
right.
It takes an hour before you even see a woman, and then when you do, you're like, oh, she's going to get with the lead guy.
Mm-hmm. And she was awesome. I loved her role, though. I thought she could have been bigger, but she was.
It could have been a bigger role, but she was kind of cool for what she was, I suppose.
It was one of the best characters in that movie.
Speaking of which, by the way, just quick, ripped from today's headlines, that sequel got delayed indefinitely. Nobody knows. Nobody's talking about why. Nobody's saying why right now. So there may be some kerfuffle. We don't know.
On the movie we're talking about today, The War of the Worlds. By the way, there's a "the" at the beginning of that. Gene Barry and Anne Robinson, who was the scientist and the love interest in the original, went back and played in the 2005 remake as grandmother and grandfather.
No way. With the deal with the Tom Cruise one?
Yep.
Oh, I like that movie. You hate it, though, probably, because of Spielberg.
No,
right?
I actually liked that movie a lot.
Yeah, I liked it quite a bit. I thought it was good. In fact, the entire time I'm watching this, I'm trying to find the parallels, right? Like, well, this is all adapted from the H.G. Wells novel, so there should be some similarities, and I don't think there's any, other than there's aliens, but that's it.
Yeah. Well, there's some similar ideas, but the thing I did not care about the 2005 version was the thing that bugs me in any movie is they implied or said that the technology was buried and had been there for thousands of years just waiting for us to evolve to a certain point. And then it pops up, and I'm like, why in the world would you bury military, equipment for, thousands of years? Because it would be totally outdated and totally freaking useless by then.
I don't remember that. That is dumb. That's
one, one little earthquake comes along in that area and it's over.
Yeah. Is that true? I don't remember that at all.
I remember because it annoyed me.
I just remembered Andy Dufresne was a weird hermit guy in a basement.
Oh, God, that's right. And, it was Tim Robbins.
Tim Robbins. And then they had Tom Cruise ran a lot.
Yeah. Yes, as always, he runs a lot. Well, it's a good reason to run this time. He plays the hysterical woman in that version.
He does. By the way, I just saw, speaking of Tom Cruise, just saw Rogue Nation last night.
I heard it was good. How was it?
It was good. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. Yeah. And,
I haven't seen it.
It's a good one to see on the big screen. And it's, you know, you can go to a theater right now and not have a full audience to see it with.
Oh, good.
Dollar movie.
Yeah, time to see the movie, I guess. It's been out a few weeks, so still in the top 10, but just barely. Yeah. We haven't let Scott Fletcher have his say. He's going to describe this movie from a... he'll do it from the DNA level. So, Scott Fletcher, take it away. Whoops. Here you go.
War of the Worlds. When a scorching meteor-like object... crashes into Earth, a scientist waits 3 ill-fated days for the object. What? This makes no sense. When a scorching meteor-like object crashes to Earth, a scientist waits 3 ill-fated days for the object. What? A spaceship filled with Martians. Meanwhile, the extraterrestrials continue their invasion of the planet. I'm sorry. That's the best I can do. Here you go. There's your blurb.
I see and understand now why Scott, when this got pulled from Netflix, this movie was originally on Netflix, was going to watch it there, and it got pulled. And Scott was like, no, it's super important. We've already got the audio from Fletcher, and it's got to be played.
Yeah, I couldn't not do it. Now, here's the funny thing. I did that in faith because I hadn't heard it. I like to save him till I'm with you guys because I don't want to, if he does something funny, I don't want to, you know, like laugh at it after the fact and go, even though I already kind of knew he did something funny. So I save him just to be as surprised as you. And man, am I glad that we did it. So for those listening who are like, man, I didn't see this on Netflix before, I'm sad. If you want to pause the show right now and go watch it on YouTube, the whole thing's there in 17 parts, but still it's there.
We also learned that it's still streaming in other countries. We may have been the unlucky ones. Oh. And if you're on UK Netflix, you might be able to watch it.
Oh, interesting. Okay. And we have
use that fancy thing that fools Netflix into thinking you're nowhere. And
could also do a browser extension that
Go to YouTube.
Yeah, there's a Chrome, right. There's a Chrome plugin. Oh, and I can't remember what it's called, but it'll let you choose what country you want everything to think that you're from.
Hack the system.
That's kind of cool.
We do not condone that, but that's doable.
Is it I don't know what region lock laws are, but that seems kind of rad. I need to get my hands on that.
Oh, that's great.
I want to see what the Canadians have.
And there's websites, Scott, that tell you. Like you can see what's streaming where in the world.
Wow. Is it going to be all like, if I do the Canadian one, do I get nothing but like Degrassi Junior High reruns?
Right. The Hoosiers?
Yeah.
It's Hoosiers. It's hockey movies and Samantha Bee.
Okay. I'm in. Anything with Donald Sutherland in it because he's a Canadian. All right. Well, there's your film there. Thank you, Scott Fletcher, for trying to explain what this thing is. Directed by Brian Haskin. He is known for lots of these sorts of things. Back then, he's made all sorts of movies that were, you know.
And unlike me and Brian, who have our names spelled like normal people, his name is Byron.
Byron. Oh, yeah, I said Brian. I meant Byron. Sorry, Byron. Right. I should know that because I told you guys the story about the old guy that my grandma dated for a while before he died that went crazy.
Wait, was he an old guy when your grandma dated him, or did you know him when he was an old guy?
No. They were dating when he was old. My grandpa died 10 years previous, and she was dating this very nicely dressed, sweater-bound man who was just this sweet man named Byron. And toward the end, though, he started to lose it. And one day we went to visit him, myself, my grandmother, my mom, and I can't remember who else, my wife probably, went to the door. This is like late 90s. Knocked on the door, opened it up, or he opened it up, or not him, a lady opened it up who's about the same age in her late 70s, early 80s, completely naked and going, Byron, there's people here to see you.
Byron, they've already seen me, so get out here now.
And he came jogging up to the door, and he was in his sweater, neatly coiffed hair, all the things you're used to seeing with him, except from the waist down, he had nothing on.
Whoa.
Yeah, we were all horrified, I have to tell you.
I would imagine. That is a scary story.
And that's when we realized that something was up. So anyway, that's my Byron story, and I don't know why I didn't recognize the name. Anyway, yes, Brian Dunaway, go ahead.
Byron worked for a time as a newspaper cartoonist. Did you know that?
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Well, that's cool. Was he good?
This was the 1920s. You didn't have to be good. You just had to be a staff cartoonist artist.
So it was just like... I can kind of visualize the style of a political cartoonist in the 20s. Just lots of spaghetti arms and legs and, you know, that whole look and feel.
Was that the Byron guy you met at the door naked? Did he have spaghetti arms?
No, he was an incredible piano player, so for the rest of his life, which wasn't long, all I could do is picture him sitting at a piano playing with no pants on. That's all I could imagine.
That's not a good idea.
No. You don't want to, and you don't want to know how he gets some of those high notes.
Yeah.
I've spent 10,000 hours playing piano. You don't go no pants.
No, you got to wear pants.
Because if that little door shuts down over the keys, that's not safe.
Gene Barry and Ann Robinson.
Because you don't want to sweat on the piano bench.
Oh, gross. No. That is gross.
Yeah, it's disgusting.
That is a DNA nightmare. Also, Ann Robinson, who played the love interest here and the only woman on Earth, she is still alive. She's still with us.
She recently did a documentary on the War of the Worlds, and they talked about the different effects they used for these special effects. And it's really good. It's on YouTube. You can look that up as well.
Have any of us here read the book this is based on?
No, no. But it was a series, and then he turned into a book in the late 1800s. So the things that they did in this movie, obviously, you know, after World War I and World War II, didn't apply. So this is loosely based.
Yeah. When you say a series, it was based on a series, like a series of books?
No, it was a serialized story.
Oh, like a serial. Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. And then they compiled it into a book.
Huh. Because I'm looking
at... And then in 1950, Orson Welles freaked everybody out.
1930s. Orson Welles.
Oh, 1930s.
Welles,
that's right.
Yeah, 1930s did the radio play that freaked everybody out, which is... I want to know if that's really true, because we've always heard that story growing up.
No,
that
it's true. I tried. I snoped it out. There were some suicides. There were people who took all their stuff, got in a van, and went south. Like, there was all kinds of freakouts from that.
It really gets to you when you think about how this book was written in the 19th century. It was written in like 1896.
Yeah.
And to think that it had been around for decades and so many people had never read it, that when they heard it on the radio, they didn't recognize it.
Right.
Like that's really remarkable how just 100 years ago, how out of touch our ancestors were with each other.
Well, not even so much that. Well, yes, I agree. That's actually kind of profound. But also... The fact that there was a book or concepts in a serialized series that was compiled into a book that was being assembled in the late 1800s that had the forethought to be looking at speculative science fiction, like thinking about alien worlds and other planets and creatures from them that would come here. That just doesn't seem like something people were doing in the 1800s. They're too busy going, I think the cornfield's on fire and where the hell's mama? Like, it's just not in my head anyway. In the stereotype in my head, we weren't thinking about science fiction yet. That didn't feel like the time where that stuff would start budding, but I guess so, right? Obviously.
Right. There had to be, I was curious about the time as well, because I was wondering if there was like a cultural renaissance or that, because the idea today for us to go, oh, there's aliens on this planet in our solar system. We don't think that because we know we've looked, we've seen, we don't see anybody just obviously there. Whereas back in the late 1800s, people probably thought maybe Mars could be people there and they could be coming soon.
Yeah. Right. That's why I thought the very beginning was so interesting with the Martians deciding which planet they were going to go to, because you realize when this book was written, and even as late as the 1950s, people's imaginations were still captured by the fact that there were planets. Just that the mere fact of planets around us.
But they had a really good idea, especially with those map paintings. Well, at least somewhat of an idea of what it would look like to live on those planets, roughly. I mean, again, it was speculation, but I mean, you can, you know, the gas giants and kind of the storms of Jupiter and things like that. Those map paintings were really, really cool.
Well, and keep in mind, this is the 50s when we did know a lot of that stuff versus, you know, for a film adaptation versus when the thing was being written.
Right.
When he was writing it feels like the guy was maybe a time traveler himself. His earlier book, The Time Machine,
I love that movie.
It's still a template for a lot of time travel tropes.
Which rendition or which version?
His original story in 1895 is the one I'm thinking of.
Brian, which
movie? I think it was the one. What year was it? I think it's the one from the 70s. It wasn't the later the earlier one.
I mean, he wrote The Invisible Man. He wrote War of the Worlds, of course. He wrote The Island of Dr. Moreau. Like, the guy's was doing things and playing with ideas that are now still kind of happening in lots of fiction. People riff on things that he sort of did. And I guess I always knew that he was this very influential, you know, singular
futurist.
Very much of a futurist, but I never really gave him the credit I think he maybe deserves for inspiring so much fiction.
And that and what's cool about War of the Worlds is he wrote it in such a way that it could be adapted in so many different ways. So I mean, has been adapted in so many different ways. Yeah, I mean the radio drama, which is told from the, you know, it's done from the perspective of, oh my God, these things are landing and here's what's happening. Mm-hmm. There's the album that I told you guys about last week, the musical rendition, which is told from the perspective of a bystander. So if you haven't listened to it yet, it is so cool. And so it holds up. I listened to it myself after telling you guys about it, and it's so good.
And then comic books, man. Oh my gosh.
Right.
Like, I can't get over how Alan Moore has just basically redone War of the Worlds. And
I haven't seen that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's a,
I knew it existed.
It's a League of Extraordinary Gentlemen book.
Oh, cool.
Interesting.
Where they just, the War of the Worlds happens, you know?
Those books are great, by the way. People should not let the movie dissuade them from reading those. They're fantastic. The movie was terrible.
And when the Steven Spielberg War of the Worlds came out 10 years ago, that's right, 10 years ago, The Asylum got in on it, and they made their version. It's called H.G. Wells, The World's in War. I'm not kidding. And you need to see this thing. It's spectacular.
Wow.
Asylum. Is there nothing can't you do?
Right.
I think that one's currently streaming on Amazon Prime, because I was trying to find alternate sources for this to let people know where they could watch it. And I looked there and they had, I think.
In one little departure for Asylum, instead of making the poster look like the film they're copying, so that when you go into the rental store, which doesn't exist anymore, you accidentally pick up their film. The Tom Cruise War of the Worlds has the alien hand holding up Earth.
Yeah.
But for some reason, in the Asylum's War, I'm sorry, The World in War, or whatever it's called, they decided to copy Independence Day.
Hey, yeah.
I'm not kidding. Their poster looks just like Independence Day.
That's a great poster, by the way.
The World in War, I believe, is it. Yeah, right. I'm looking at
The World's in War. Yeah. H.G. Wells. The World's in War.
Yeah, and that one's, if you want to see that on Amazon, it's there, and it's terrible. I just skipped around through it thinking, well, maybe this is it. So I started just throwing the cursor around and like, holy crap, that looks bad. It's got a lot of nudity in it, which is, you know, there's that.
Some trauma nudity. Oh, by the way, the time machine that I was referring to, Ibit, was 1960.
Oh,
I
knew 60. It was. Okay, yeah. I think that's the one I'm thinking of too.
Yeah, that's a memorable thing.
The Poloi, or what were there, and the Morlocks. Was it the Poloi? Right. No, what were the Eloi?
HGOL was actually Rod Taylor in that one. I think that's why it was so dang.
Rod Taylor.
So check this out.
Right, there was. I'm sorry.
Here's some good trivia for you. The sound effect of the Martian War Machine's heat ray thing, you know, the beep 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 beep. That thing was created from three electric guitars played backwards. So they would record electric guitars, play them backwards, and that's the sound you got from
How
that.
How do you play a guitar backwards?
I'm so confused. You put the strings against your body and then strum the back?
No, they mean record it and then play it backwards.
I like that idea, though.
You reverse the audio.
You hold the base of it in your hand and then put the neck against your...
I'm pretty convinced Kurt Cobain was playing a guitar backwards.
Yeah. No, literally playing the sound of
left-handed?
It backwards.
Left-handed strung backwards. That's just weird.
Yeah.
I will never understand how there are famous people who made their living playing it strung backwards.
Right. Let's see. The sound
Which
of the Martian.
I read that and I listened to that and I still could not hear the sound of a
guitar.
An electric guitar at all. Like it.
Right.
And I swear to God that sound has been used for Filmation or like, you know, all those Hanna-Barbera or something. There was something that noise was
very familiar, wasn't it?
This
movie was a huge influence on sci-fi that followed after this. So I mean, absolutely, they got these sounds that were probably in the sound bank, and they put them away and said, yeah, we're gonna use those later.
I kept having this feeling too. There were a couple of moments when they were slowly panning the camera toward the unscrewing of the top of the ship or the pod or whatever.
And
a couple of other shots in the movie that felt like modern filmmaking to me.
Right.
They felt new, and I realized, maybe this inspired that particular camera move or that particular kind of piece of, you know, walking up to the thing with the flag and waving it
When you talk to filmophiles, they always tell you, no, you got to go back to Orson Welles. Like, that's where you get your you know, your initiation into where to move a camera and so on. Mm-hmm. But man, I watch those old Orson Welles movies and it just, I go to sleep.
Yeah, they're tiring.
They're slow, but that's good because that gives you an opportunity to see what he's doing. Well, like, oh, there it is.
I've never seen, this is a shame moment for me, but I've never seen the one he's most famous for, the Rosebud one. What's
Red
it called?
Rob.
Oh, no, yeah, Citizen Kane.
Citizen Kane. I've never seen Citizen Kane. It's supposed to be the
Citizen Kane.
Greatest film ever made.
I haven't seen it either, so I'm with you, brother.
Maybe we should do that.
Coming back to the point, Citizen Kane's only like 11 years older than this movie. Mm. So it's not like it was a, you know, a lifetime of
true, but he didn't direct this, first of all. But second of all, when 10 years from 1943 to 53, that's a bigger 10 years than say 2005 to 2015. You know what I mean? Like,
right. A lot going on after World War II.
We're in the long tail now of this sort of where we are with film. Back then it was like, that's a huge jump or a huge leap. Well, not only just color, but
yeah, this was filmed in Technicolor, which was just the film still looks, even in our crappy YouTube 4:3 aspect ratio, still looks amazing.
Mm-hmm. Look pretty good. Yeah. I have to say the special effects for the time and for other things we can compare it to film sack wise, pretty good. You know, like there is worse out there for sure. Their budget was $2 million. 600,000 of that, which is 30% of that, was spent on live action scenes.
Is that $2 million this today, or is that $2 million then?
That's probably adjust that for inflation, and who knows? It's probably in the $30 million or $40 million range or something. I don't know.
Right.
But it was 70% of the budget was spent on, which is $1.4 million of that was spent on the special effects and miniatures and all that stuff. So
mostly that alien creeping by in the window.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right, with their little Sony Trinitron red, blue, green. I had a bunch of those little aliens in my old CRT TV.
Did you really?
It's going to blow one of my alternate titles, but I'll just tell you now what that reminded me of. It looked like a Simon Says electronic game.
Oh, the Simon game. Yeah, no Simon kidding. Game.
Yep.
Was it a Simon? Like, yeah, it was called Simon,
just
right?
Simon, yeah.
Where you'd
except
hit the,
no yellow.
Yeah, you'd have to. Oh, that's right. There was no yellow, but but also kind of like the you'd have the friend growing up whose dad bought the big projection TV and it had the big three lights behind it, the red, green, blue.
Right. Yeah.
That was all very reminiscent of that for me.
And if you ever looked closely at a one of those old TVs like a CRT TV, they had those. You know, each little pixel was a red, blue, green,
right,
little triangle of them, and on some of them anyway, and.
Triangles.
So it's kind of funny. It's funny that they just mauled it right after that.
Yeah.
Right. I guess it's just basic. It's just basics. And, you know, speaking of patterns, when they were drawing out the pattern of attack on how they were doing things, it was cracking me up because I don't remember the exact line, but he says, yeah, they go up, over, and repeat. And I was thinking, yeah, that's just like Space Invaders.
That's exactly a good point.
It is
right.
A good point.
Left and right, and then when they get to the right, they drop down a level.
Yeah, and they go faster the more you eliminate.
We'll hide behind these blocks. We can shoot through them.
I just realized they spent over $1 million on effects for this film. Can you imagine having $1 million in 1953?
No, that's a lot of freaking money, dude.
You could buy like Sonoma County or something.
Yeah. No, that's huge. That is a huge amount of money. I'm in the middle of reading Stephen King's 11/23/63 or 11/22/63.
Oh, really? I'm reading that too.
Book's great. Real good so far. I love how they handle time travel. But anyway, he's in 53 right now. So he's in this year. And that's all I could think about through this thing. Or you know, like Brandy just said, look at these numbers and go, man, just imagine what George, whatever his last name, his fake last name in that book is, could spend, what he could buy with that kind of cash.
Oh, wow.
It's incredible. I mean, this is the definition of a huge budget film for that era.
And it's dudes walking around on a crappy outdoor set.
Yeah.
It's a set.
Yeah.
So set.
With horrible wardrobe. Like,
and some bad B footage of like tank shooting and intermingled with
the
like
stock footage. Yeah. I wish we were doing a video cast for once.
Yeah. Right. But it was actually so much.
Yeah.
But all of it wasn't stock though. A lot of it they filmed out in Nevada. They just went out there and they were actually filming military maneuvers
like
that
the
they were practicing.
Flying wing stuff, like
now the flying wing stuff. That was probably
that had
and
to
all
be stock
the beginning
photos.
Stuff with the World War I when a bunch of people fought, and then World War II when more people fought, and it was all in color.
Yeah, you notice that was Orson Welles' voice. So they did that.
H.G. Wells or Orson Welles?
Orson Welles.
Yeah. Or an imitation. It was supposed to, I think it was an imitation.
It was a really good imitation if that's what it was.
Yeah.
Because he's not credited anywhere, so you're probably right.
Well, there was one of the pieces of trivia on IMDb. Let me find it really quick.
Oh, yeah, track that down. Because what was interesting is I also noticed at one point that reporter who's running around with a microphone the whole time seemed to be using his voice, and I couldn't tell if it was dubbed or it was actually his.
Yeah, there is, and that is somebody doing, there it is right there. As an homage to Orson Welles and his famous War of the Worlds radio broadcast on Sunday evening, October 30th, 1938 on radio, voice specialist Paul Frees appears on screen as a radio reporter and does his famous Orson Welles vocal impersonation.
It's really good.
It is really good, but it is funny, like, I'm Paul Frees, and I'm known for my famous Orson Welles vocal impersonation. Who? Who? It's my famous.
You know, Paul Frees.
Paul Frees.
Everyone knows me.
You might know me from such things as impersonations of Orson Welles.
And that's it. That's all.
That's all.
My life. So if you were hoping to get to somewhere and purchase one of these things on eBay, one of these Martian war machines, none of them exist today. They were made out of copper, and after the production, they were reportedly donated to a Boy Scout copper drive.
Right. Oh, wow.
Copper drive?
Yeah. We had that once.
Military. Needed it.
When I was a kid, we had a copper drive. Part of that is because we have a copper mine near where I lived, and it's very impossible it was tied into that. It was some sort of joint thing where all the Boy Scout troops did something. But yeah, I've heard of this. You just have all your excess copper things, wires, cables, whatever, and you'd go collect them, and then you'd take them down to the mine, and they would refine them. And then we did a big tour watching them melt down existing copper and turn it into raw copper stuff. It was pretty cool.
Yeah, oh, hey, cool. One more. I'm going to say one more thing about Paul Frees that'll blow your mind, and then I'll be done with Paul Frees,
all right.
Okay?
All right, no more Paul Frees.
I did open this up, and now it's like, oh, my God, this has to be said, or somebody's going to email us. So in addition to being a lot of voices for the Rankin and Bass Christmas shows, like he was Jack Frost and Rudolph and Frosty's Christmas in July. Rudolph's Shiny New Year, he was Santa Claus. He was also the voice of Carr. K-A-R-R, Kit versus Car on Knight Rider.
Kit versus Car.
What?
Nice.
Yes.
No way, dude.
Mind blown.
All right, he's officially one of my favorite people ever.
I thought you might want to hear that. But anyway, let's get back to Copper Drives.
He died in 66 at the age of, or no, I'm sorry, 86 at the age of 66. A lot of sixes in there.
It's kind of young.
Yeah. No, that's actually kind of rad. No, I'm glad you brought that up. I love that Car episode. What was the semi called? He was called something else.
Goliath.
Was it called Goliath?
I'm pretty sure it was Goliath.
Oh, that's badass.
Never argue with Brian Dunaway about rap trivia like that.
It was a little too fast on that. He probably knows it.
So we'll hear all this in the clips, but I just absolutely love to everyone talked in this. Brian or Randy's right. It would just be, I just love that era of like, yeah. Listen here, see, we got to go. Right. Oh, and there are no black people. Where are all the black people?
Oh,
no Trump alert.
None. Like, literally, this movie. Hold on, where is it?
Trump alert, hold on. But there. Yeah. But not only are there no black people, but there's one Hispanic.
Yeah, one guy.
Yes. God. One of the three
maybe we could give them burritos and tacos.
Yeah, that was the worst thing.
That's realistic.
At first I thought, we'll have a slightly ethnically mixed townspeople. It'll be an interesting way of showing, can't we all get along? And his only real line in the movie before he gets vaporized was how we can give them enchiladas and welcome them to our town.
Right.
Holy crap.
There was a very serious rules of three going on in this movie, and I couldn't quite ever put my finger on it, but they had three was very important.
Like three in the eyeball with the colors, three people seemed always hanging out.
Yeah, right. Three people approaching the first ship and getting vaporized. Yeah.
And there's dialogue talking about the formations of three and how they do stuff. I never could quite put my finger on what
obviously
they were
the they're called tripods. What the
oh yeah, exactly. Although they didn't have them walk here because obviously the special effects tech at the time wouldn't allow for such things.
That would have been a little much.
But
that
asking
busted their $1 million budget.
Paul Frees rhymes with Paul Threes.
You just blew my mind again.
Think of that. Yeah, Paul Frees came up again, everyone.
Right.
We got one more chance to talk about Orson Welles.
Were we just getting into, was the public conscious not really aware of Geiger counters before this movie? Because
I doubt it. Highly doubt it. Like, if you think about it, all of our nuclear development was done in secret. And by our, I mean our great-grandparents' generation did a lot of science in secret, right?
Yeah.
And then there, like, the news would come along and say, So there's this thing called radiation, and everybody's like, ooh, right? Yeah. Like, yeah, a Geiger counter was a mysterious thing.
I guess so.
You got some kind of bomb back here, son? Let me take a look. Let me point this around at the meteor. Yep, meteor, hot, car, not. Ladies' boobs, yes.
Mm-hmm.
No, car, not.
I mean, this would have also, this would have been the height of people, of the freak out over nuclear proliferation. Right.
Like, no, that was actually, as far as I can see, the early 80s, believe it or not.
No, interesting.
Like, I've just recently read a book about
the
nuclear side of the Cold War.
Yeah, I can see that, I guess. I suppose that's true. It
took a long time for the world to understand what in the world that was. Like the bomb over Japan, it was just a big bomb. It wasn't like the nuclear aspects of it were well understood for a long time.
Sure. But they, yeah, exactly. That's true, because I doubt this generates. So that maybe explains it, I guess. The Geiger counter comes out, and people are like, oh, that's interesting. What the hell's that? Like, no, that would have been a thing that would have been relegated to government testing in Nevada or, you know, underground bomb tests or whatever.
And it might be a little bit about not understanding the radioactivity in outside of our own planet as well, because I would have thought when I saw him do that, I was like, you had a Geiger counter in the back of your car, and the first thing you didn't do was jump out like a scientist and run around and going, everybody back, everybody back.
Yeah. Yeah. What's radiation? Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Right. You know, this would be a fun time for me to use my Geiger counter.
This would be great.
I'm a hobbyist, a little bit of a hobbyist when it comes to detecting radiation.
You got the townspeople over there trying to fry eggs on it.
Yeah.
Well, and when they first turned it on, you could tell, like, it starts clicking madly, and I'm like, run! Get out of there. Yeah, what are you doing?
Exactly. Yeah, just standing in it, man.
Well, I do like the fact that the first thing you see is a guy whacking it with a shovel.
Yeah.
The
tow truck driver. That cracked me up.
Gold mine, I say.
You know,
he's got this with a shovel.
You know what surprised? This is not related, but it reminds me of this. Maybe Ibbot and I were talking on TMS about it, but it was the fact that astronauts, when they go up to the International Space Station, experience more radiation in one trip than any of us would in, like, what was it like
5,250 trips back and forth from LA to New York.
Yeah. Which I also didn't realize gave you radiation.
sure.
It shows how little I know
only
about
if you're
how
flying Frontier.
Yeah.
Like, Scott, you live a few thousand feet higher than I do. So you're getting a little more radiation from the sun every day.
Yeah, I guess so.
Wow. I'm closer to the radiation.
Also, it didn't occur to me until yesterday. I was listening to some other science-y thing and I didn't know that it took a full 4 minutes for the sun's radiation to leave the sun and hit me in the face.
Right.
It's more like 8 minutes, but
exactly. Seven was a number I always heard. Like if the sun went out, we wouldn't know for 7 minutes.
Isn't that a weird thing
we'd
to think about?
Living in bliss for 7 minutes. We would
be down in our square dance, having a good time.
Right. Square dancing, right.
Yeah.
Drinking our soda pop with a straw. What's wrong with you people?
Yeah, exactly. But it occurred to me like that kind of thing just weirds me out. Like the idea that SETI is sitting around listening for alien communication and we're trying to figure out what they would have used to communicate with. Is it on Z waves or, you know, all this kind of stuff that we can't detect yet or whatever. And then I thought, well, wait, even when we do figure it out, go, oh, we finally got all our big dishes, finally captured some alien race talking to us or sending out some signal. The thing they sent out would have been from thousands, perhaps millions of years ago.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Right. Like just now getting it. It's not what they are today. It's what they were then.
You're just now getting it. That's funny.
And you know, but you know, he mentions that, but I think about it too. I'm like, this is something I've been thinking about last couple of weeks a lot is that we think that we hear these, all these odds. It's like, okay, there's these however many planets and solar systems. There's got to be intelligent life out there somewhere. But then when you throw in, you know, the idea of time and how long time is, it's like, okay, now all of a sudden, maybe our, you know, chances of running into some other life form that's living right now that is intelligent, that would be able to reach us throughout all time, it's like, okay, maybe it's a little tougher than we think.
It's infinitesimal.
I want to bring this conversation all the way around. So it takes light 8 minutes to get from the sun to the earth.
Right.
Light. Right. Traveling at the speed of light.
Light. Did you know light's really fast? Light.
Oh, well, then that means it's eight. Wait. Hold on, then that would be 8 years of his light years. How far away is the sun from us? It's like
eight light minutes.
93 million miles.
Right. Okay. That's the basic measurement
just,
of,
right.
of
so just
speed and time.
Yeah, just go with me here, all right?
Eight light minutes,
if
got
you're,
it.
If you're sitting on Pluto, which we photographed a couple months ago.
Yeah.
If you're sitting
not
on
not
Pluto,
us, but not the hosts of FilmSack, but yes.
Right, we did it.
Human beings.
Let's say you are.
Okay.
Randy,
let's
Randy
say you
took
did the photographs.
It was great.
All right.
It takes the light from the sun over 5 hours to get to Pluto. That's how far away Pluto is.
Oh, wow.
So
then there's rays in the back going, are we ever going to get there? Are we there yet?
So Scott, you got to just take a moment and think about what kind of Wi-Fi connection was going on where a ping is over 5 hours long.
Yeah, that's a good
okay.
point.
How the hell did we ever get the pictures back? I don't understand that. But anyway, so former Blizzard employee Andy Weir writes a book called The Martian.
Yeah,
it becomes a movie.
I
can't wait to see this movie.
Wow.
And the reason I can't wait to see this movie is because it's so realistic about the distances. It's the distances from here to Mars and so forth. I'm just really excited about
it. It's very accurate.
I didn't realize he was a former Blizzard employee. That's cool.
Yep.
Yeah.
Back in the 90s.
It was early. But what was his primary job there? Was he writing game?
Programmer.
Oh, programming? Okay. Oh, I didn't know that.
His head Viking designer.
By the way, that guy, freaking hats off. That's awesome. I'm super stoked for him. That's a huge movie with an incredible cast, and like, what a dream come true mm-hmm. must be for him to have. It's not even his first movie or his first book. He's got other books, but
right, it's his first recognized, and it seems so relatable to everything that independent content creators are doing, because he didn't make it through. He started his book on Inkshare or something. Isn't that like? Is that the story?
I think this one may have been published through Crown Publishing, though.
Okay.
I'm not sure, though. Oh, no, you're right. It was a Kindle, you know, like a Kindle self-published deal.
Right, right. And so, and it just went from this, you know, relatively nobody, and all of a sudden, so quickly, I mean, just bam.
No. If you think that you can't finally hit your mark when you're 43, as he is, then you mm-hmm. are smoking the crack. Everybody can figure it out.
What just blows my mind is how you can capture imagination still today. Like, when people go see this movie, they're going to be people who are genuinely surprised at how long it takes to get from Earth to Mars.
Yeah.
Like, and Andy
or will
Weir,
I fall asleep?
Probably.
Andy Weir's imagination was captured by that simple fact, you know, years ago when he wrote a book.
He worked at AOL, then Blizzard, and worked on Warcraft 2. So if you played Warcraft 2, Tides of Darkness, well, then you know what the hell happened there. All right. Well, what else? Anything else? No black people. I already mentioned that. Where are the black people?
Can we talk about the sound effects in this movie? I mean, I felt like I was constantly being raped my ears by between the special, the laser beams and the lady screaming.
Well, be prepared to have that happen to you again here in a minute. But yes,
I wanted to blame that on YouTube. I figured this was just a bad transfer.
I think there's maybe
everything else sounded pretty clear.
Yeah,
you know?
I think it's the movie. I think they didn't know what they were doing then.
Well, I think it was probably intentional to make you feel uncomfortable, but I think we've also found a nicer balance in later years, because I don't think the sound was as important, because the reproduction of the sound in these theater houses weren't as fine as they are now.
They weren't.
Thank George Lucas for ushering in THX and really focusing on wonderful sound.
Well, dude, back in the day, there wasn't. I mean, Star Wars, when it premiered, most theaters were doing like mono audio. There wasn't even a way to like hear it in stereo, let alone surround. So I think this is just how stuff sounded then. And this would not be the first example of a film we've seen that was made in the 50s that sounded terrible. You know, like all the science fiction stuff we've seen, they always choose to have some ear-ringing, awful, Geiger countery kind of like device or something. Like mm-hmm. the Red Planet Mars one we watched, they had that terrible high-pitched
thing,
whatever that was. This is like that, I think. Just a little more mainstream and a little more expensive.
Right.
I've got a ton of clips. We should just dive into these.
Let's get into the clips.
Let's do some clips.
Make me a sandwich, woman.
Hey, too early
to get hysterical.
Yeah.
Over easy.
Hysterical.
Hysterical. All right, this is the kind of intro you get in a movie like this. So here you go. I like that a lot.
Yeah, and they show like 11 people's names on the screen all at the same time.
Yep.
Could you imagine, you know, them doing that today with all the A-list stars and just putting everybody's name all on there at once?
Oh my gosh, dude. I mean, they do it sometimes.
Pissed off, they'd be, wait a minute, no, I wanted my name to be on there only.
You know what? Tarantino could get away with that.
You think so?
Oh, he could. Yeah.
Yeah, actually, I guess he kind of does. get away with that.
Like, if he listed all of the Hateful Eight.
Yeah. He may do that. Oh, I'm looking forward to that movie so much.
Really?
Yeah.
His last few movies, I see a trailer and I'm like, yes, Inglourious Bastards, that's amazing. And then I go see the movie and I'm like, oh, this is what Tarantino does now. The same thing over and over.
Really? I loved his last few movies. I thought Django was Django, I thought was great.
Django.
I love Django. So look, they're Westerns. No one else is really making them. I wish there were. And if he's going to make one, great. So yeah, whatever. I'm looking forward to it. Listen, the whole premise of that movie is a bunch of outlaws and a couple of good guys are trapped inside of a saloon in a huge winter storm and nobody can get in or out. That's great.
And they're all enemies. Yeah.
That's great.
Mm-hmm. It's so like excited. The Breakfast Club with thugs.
Yeah.
And one of them's going to be wearing little welder's goggles. And yeah, I know.
Well,
I'm just saying, Tarantino's putting me to sleep doing the same tricks every time.
Wow.
I'm tired of
it. You're going to get some hateful emails on this one.
I'm so tired of you, Tarantino.
Hateful emails.
Yeah. Who knows?
Eight of them.
Eight hateful emails. Eight angry men. All right, so we're going to play the next one here. This is War is Hell, a little bit of War is Hell.
In the First World War, and for the first time in the history of man, nations combined to fight against nations using the crude weapons of those days. The Second World War involved every continent on the globe, and men turned to science for new devices of warfare, which reached an unparalleled peak in their capacity for destruction.
He sounds a lot like Orson Welles.
He does. That's, more Paul Frees work and...
Wow.
Santa Claus and a bunch of those Rankin and Bass things and...
one day
Shazam,
play car.
The old 60s Saturday morning Shazam.
Yeah.
Good voice for that. Lots of intros. Lots of narration work as far as like intros of things.
Good for him.
Yeah.
He's the Nolan North of his time.
Right.
Ooh, interesting.
Yeah. Well, who knows? Maybe not. I don't know. Like if you compare, like he's maybe the Nolan North. Who would be
I just want to say I'm on Team Dinklage. I think everybody has to declare themselves on a team.
Oh, yeah. I go. I'm Nolan North every time. That Dinklage reading for that stupid character ghost in Destiny is terrible. He's terrible in it.
Oh, he's great.
I think Dinklage's reading was better, and it's just evidence that it's a matter of directing in script more than.
I think it's a matter of interpretation. That is a horrible reading. It's awful. And Dinklage is a great actor. He's no voice actor though. Ugh, that is shit in Destiny.
Okay. This is so real... Scott is Team North.
Big time. Right. Big time.
It's what
team
we're
North.
Getting out of this, I think.
Team anyone else? I would have taken any other read. It's bad. Like I'm literally surprised to hear you say that. I thought that Dinklage thing was maybe the worst video game VO I've heard in maybe a decade.
Wow. Well,
I think what happens for a lot of people is you play the game 100 hours and you get used to it.
Maybe.
And then they went and changed it. And who does that?
Well, here's why they did it. Well, there's lots of rumored reasons why they did it. But I think the main reason they did it is because it was bad and it was a mistake. So they went back and fixed it. That's why they did it. All right.
They certainly didn't improve much.
Here's that may be true. Here's something my dad used to talk or to sound like when he'd say things. Here you go.
Well, what's it look like?
Can't get near enough to see it very well. It's too hot. But it's a whale of a size.
He used to say that all the time. It's a whale of a size.
Whale of a size.
Yeah. It's a whale of a size. It's a whopper.
It's a real whopper, see? Here's what talking with your mouth full will get you.
The district office is 4 inches to look out up in the summit.
Don't play cards with that guy, by the way.
Right. Oh, he's such a cheetah. Such a cheetah.
I didn't trust him for
the minute. You know, that used to be, that we've seen that in several older movies. There's always some guy who's doing his job and then some guy back there cheating.
Mm-hmm. That was a lot. But listen how, I really don't know what he said here.
The district office is 4 inches to look out up in the summit.
I don't know what he said.
No, he's going to come in.
Something about the forest lookout at the summit.
Yeah.
That's my favorite clip.
Are you going to eat that?
Can I have a cigarette out of your pocket?
These guys are out camping early in the film. These guys are out camping.
Scientists out camping.
Some civil authority goes looking for them to tell them there's been a meteor and the scientist needs to be found.
Yeah.
And he finds them sitting at a card table and a campsite with a plane parked out behind them.
Yeah.
I'm just like, what was life like for these people?
Yeah. It's all very, what's the word? It's very unbelievable. 1950s. I also like how they want to show how the rest of the world is dealing with the problem. Right. And this is an easy thing to do. They just show stock footage from a bunch of news shots of like World War II riots and say, oh, in Japan, they're doing this. And over in France, they're doing that. And in Turkey, they're doing this. And they just show all this other stuff. And it's such a easy way to say this is much bigger than this farmland in California. I feel like we're a lot better at this today than we were back then. Because we can make a quick digital representation of the Eiffel Tower getting crashed down by an alien and then go, ah, yeah, France. Oh, they're dealing with it too, are they? Well, okay, back to hometown USA. Like, it's just harder then to show that, I guess.
Well, also, nowadays, we have the internet and we have smartphones and everything, so a movie can depict a genuinely global issue.
Yeah.
Whereas back in the day, it was just, I mean, people felt like the other side of the world may as well be the other side of the universe.
Yeah, that's true. Here's our Mexican man, all right? So
Mexican man.
Here he is.
We can sell it to Mollys and the enchiladas and the hot dogs, too.
Yeah, ice cream, cold drinks, souvenirs.
Yeah, that's how we should get the aliens to like us.
Why does the Mexican like hot dogs? I don't understand.
I understood enchiladas, tamales. Yeah, but then hot dogs.
Why you're trying to feed us tubes of meat?
Yeah, meat tubes.
Meat tubes.
Here's
you shove them in your screw hole.
Here's a here's a weird way to pronounce no. I thought so. Here you go.
No, don't do that. No.
That guy's great. I like this laugh. That one's pretty good.
Wow.
I had the Mexican guy in it, I think. Did you hear him at the end?
Yeah.
Women don't know nothing.
I don't understand why a meteor that size didn't make a bigger crater.
Oh, it hit sideways and skidded in. At least that's what I think. I don't really know. But the ranger said a scientist is coming from Pacific Tech. He'll tell us.
He'll tell us because I'm a woman and I don't know shit.
Wait, that's you.
Yeah.
Oh my God, so much sexism in this movie.
Big time.
Against the one woman.
Yeah, the one woman in the entire film, and she knows nothing.
Nothing, except she knows those aliens keep trying to probe her with that eye.
Oh, yeah. With the Simon game. Something you never heard in 1953 is what I wrote. I don't remember what this is. So here it is. Something you'd never hear in 1953.
Say, do you have a match?
No, I'm sorry. I don't smoke.
Oh, yeah. Everyone smoked that. At least according to...
There was a lot of smoking in this movie.
Yeah. I'm reading that book, and everyone smokes in that book, and they're always pointing it out that just people chain smoke like crazy in 53.
I was curious because he was like, the scientist was like, no, I don't smoke. Well, I'm smart enough to know that we've looked at those records. You don't want to smoke.
Yeah.
It'll kill you.
Yeah.
I
wonder what it meant to say that then. It feels like there was a social thing happening, but it wasn't that, smoking's bad for you. It was something else. It was like him not being cool, maybe. Maybe I'm a scientist. Right. I'm a little bit of a square, so I don't smoke.
He's so square.
Yeah, I don't know.
He can't fly with shit. I know that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Jeez. He can keep his hair in good shape when he's after the attack, though. Him and her, they look like they were dressed to the best.
Right.
Even,
right.
Even though they were in a house being bombed by giant penis creatures. Worst square dance of all time. This guy, the guy calling the square dance, just really, it was really bad.
Do you have audio of it?
I do. Here it is.
Oh,
here
yes.
You go.
Alaman left in a lady star. Gents walk around, but not too far. Alaman left in a gentleman star. Ladies walk around, but not too far.
We taught robots how to call the dance.
I am not programmed to love.
Or dance.
Or dance. Human dance, human. All right, here's
hold on. That square dance had one of my favorite tropes.
Oh yeah, what do you got there? Hold on, damn it. Here we go.
Oh, this is something I don't think we've ever talked about on FilmSack. It's called the nuclear candle. All right.
Okay.
So the square dance is lit by candles, right?
Yeah. Right.
And
right.
When the lights go out, that room gets dark.
Mm. Yeah.
Like how was that candle putting out that much light?
And then the backlights come up, right?
Yeah.
Interesting.
The nuclear candle. I love that little trope.
That's pretty good. All right, how about this? This is one of the horrible sounds. And as a kid, I remember this very distinctly, seeing this on probably TV or whatever, but I remember it just freaking me out. So here's some of this. Yeah. It gets louder, too. Oh, it just goes down to your soul.
That's another sound that's been reused for so many other different things.
I'm pretty sure that's somewhere in a Star Trek episode. I'm
probably
yeah. That feels like 60s Star Trek to me.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Actually, most of the sound effects in this film, even the beep, 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 that sounded like a
beep, 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 beep.
Yeah, that's very Star Trek. This still kind of gets me right here, though. This whole lead up to their deaths. I don't know why. I just thought it was handled pretty well. So here's that.
Your friend. That's right. We welcome you. We're friends. Yeah.
I don't know. It feels intense, man.
We're friends,
Yeah. It just seems intense.
Now, was that the preacher man? Was that
no? That was the three guys. Amigos. Those are the three amigos, yeah. Dude. Yeah. They're the ones that when they found their charred bodies or their leftovers, one guy must have had a huge head because he had this huge pile of dust that used to be his head.
No, I've talked about this before. I used to creep me out. It still does somewhat, but being in something that nothing remains, whereas a disintegration ray is always just disturbed me. Even watching that, and I forget which episodes of Star Trek it was, but in the original series where they zap people and they were just
like a pile of salt.
Piles of salt. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't like that either.
What's great though is like they would turn into piles of ash that were in the same perspective as the camera was looking down on. So like the RB Jeep.
Yeah.
Like you're looking at three quarter view down and the ash pile would be the outline of the three quarter view.
Right.
Yeah. Which I understand at the time what they were trying to do. They couldn't be so dynamic, but
right.
It was kind of a funny effect. I like the way they handled them in the 2009 because they were really getting vaporized like in real time because we could do that then. Mm-hmm. And even that, just I can't. I'm with Brian. I don't like. There's something about being reduced to something that is absolutely not human anymore.
Right.
That freaks me out. Mm-hmm. I don't like it. A pile of dust and that's it. That's all you are now. Like even the Batman movie we all watched together where the different colors of salt were left on the chairs.
Yeah.
When the people got zapped, I didn't like that.
Oh, yeah.
It's also kind of racist, but whatever.
I forgot about that. The yellow dust.
Yeah,
right. Yellow dust. Well, all the different Japanese colors guy. Of dust, right?
Yeah. And then depending on what country you're from, depending
on
what
you're from. Exactly. The Chinaman totally is yellow
and
dust.
And then they got them all mixed up together. And
yeah. It kind of freaked me out. All right, here's the hearing aid part. I don't remember. Oh, the old man. That's what this is.
What are they saying, honey? Something's wrong with my hearing aid.
I don't know why he was even in there.
was
that just to illustrate that old people were at peril as well? Or I don't know what that was for. I don't know why that was in there.
Because they were illustrating the fact that all electronic devices were affected. Magnetism. They had a little science class over there on the table.
Oh, everything but the car.
Yeah, give me a pin.
Yeah. Somehow that Jeep still worked.
Yeah, not in the new world, War of the Worlds, the War of the Worlds.
Yeah, everything went down in the new one, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What was the movie where that was a huge part of the story? Oh, is it Day After? Not Day After Tomorrow. The Day After with Jason Robards where the new kit leader. And every car shut down ahead of it or whatever from the first EMP blast or whatever.
And people were losing their pacemakers and...
That was a huge deal, that movie. You know what? And that came out right when Randy says the early 80s when things were at a fevered pitch.
Yeah.
For that
stuff.
Yeah,
I remember not my folks not letting me watch that.
Yeah. That was a big deal.
There was a big controversy about that.
Yeah. Man, what a weird.
Yeah, right.
It's weird.
You look back on that. How quaint.
Yeah, it's very quaint. All right. I love the reporter. You love the reporter. So here's more of the reporter.
There's been a lot of mysterious activity around the machine. Lights and dust as if they're digging themselves out. And there it comes again.
Yeah. Reporters running around with microphones are my favorites. I think everyone thought a reporter back then was like the guy who saw the Hindenburg go down. You know what I mean? So like every reporter in a movie was always like, oh no, the humanity, and just running around.
Right. And they even talk about that in the Wikipedia article about the 1938 broadcast, the radio broadcast, how the guy went and listened to the Hindenburg reporter a bunch of times to get that right level of panic.
Oh, wow. Wow. Yeah. I think that for them during that time, that would have been like a reporter on the ground on 9/11 now or something.
Right. Yeah. Listening to people screaming. It's like, wow, that's.
Yeah. It's our version. It's
really daring to go to a dark place to kind of get some.
Well, and it's the trope of the darkest hour. This film really sets up that trope. Like I've never really seen an earlier example. I'm sure there is one of the darkest hour. It's now such a common thing in movies.
Like, everything has its darkest hour. Everybody.
Especially like Christopher Nolan films.
Yeah.
And this film, man, it's bleak. Ooh.
Yeah.
There's nothing left to hope for.
It's somewhat effective. Like it actually kind of, some of that stuff, like I keep saying, it held up in a way that I didn't expect. I didn't expect some of the emotional part of it to hit me the way it did and feel desperate and feel existentially doomish, right? But then cheesy dialogue would interrupt it, or you know, something dumb would happen or whatever, but there was still a feeling of they captured the feeling that what it would be like to have society completely uprooted by an event like this. And I don't know, I guess hats off to them for making that seem okay for a 2015 brain. Here's what? Oh, activity around the machine, I wrote.
There's been a lot of mysterious activity around the machine.
Oh, I don't know why I did that again.
Love it when your note about the clip is exactly the words in the clip.
Perfect. How about this one?
I'm here to make up a report, not to interfere with the operations you've set up. You're still in command.
No one talks like that anymore. Right. I love that guy. Mm-hmm. He's great. Okay.
And where did they get it from? So you got an actor who thinks that that's how people are supposed to talk to each other. Mm-hmm. Where did the actor learn to talk like that?
I don't know.
He a radio man?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a link that maybe Tom gave me this, I think, maybe, because we were having a discussion about this on Current Geek. And if you go, and I don't know where to even search for it, I'll have to try to track it down, maybe put it on the Twitter feed. But it was this big description of why people talked like that on the radio. That it wasn't just how people talked. They were doing this because there was a very specific thinking around why it needed to be sounding like that.
Like having a specific enunciation made it easier for people to follow and understand kind
yes,
of thing.
Yes, and you had to be, and also when you would punctuate your words like this, it was because the technology at the time was a little muted if you just talked like a normal guy.
Right.
The effect was people would start talking like that because people would listen to a lot of radio and then it would kind of permeate the culture. But it's an right. interesting story. I wish I knew where that link was. It's very interesting. Goes into all that
That's
stuff.
Interesting.
Anyway.
It's bizarre. It's like any other fad, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Like you look at a fad and go, what? How did everyone decide to wear these glasses or yeah. whatever it is? Like,
part of it is, I think, just the stage mentality. We didn't start getting over that till the early 60s, where we realized that film could be very different than what stage acting is. And everything didn't need to be three guys going, look over there, what do you see? Just like some old, you know, mm-hmm. Tennessee Williams play. It can be dynamic camera angles and subtle acting and quiet moments and whispering. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to all be from this, you know, this throaty, I'm on a stage and no one can hear me kind of Shakespearean level thing.
There's a Def Leppard documentary. There's something you didn't expect me to say.
No.
there's a Def Leppard documentary where they briefly touch on how early, like at some point earlier in the existence of Def Leppard, microphones got really good and you didn't have to sing loud in the studio. You could sing softly.
Yeah.
And that just blew my mind. I'm like, whoa, they're singing softly. And, you know, then you let the electronics do all the work. That's amazing.
Like the love bites. Love then later they crank it up. No, let's see. Religious. Oh, they brought some religion in here. So here's a viewpoint.
Oh, there was lots of
some.
here's a viewpoint you always like.
They are living creatures out there.
They're not human. Dr. Forrester says they're some kind of advanced civilization.
If they're more advanced than us, they should be nearer the Creator for that reason.
There's some logical jump there for you. Go ahead and walk out in front of them. See how it works for you there, buddy.
And right. I'm possessed.
Quick, somebody call a priest.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a lot of religious discussions in this, as well as skepticism, and Darwinism was a large part of the original book. So,
well, the movie definitely went down the road of like so there's this big group of the top men. All right, the best scientists we can throw at this, the most important military men, the president, whoever else. They're all in this big circle, and the woman says, or they say, well, by our estimations, it'll only take them 3 days to restore the entire world, see? And she goes, it only took 7 to create it.
Yeah.
And then
right.
they took,
yeah.
And
yeah.
then they all looked at each other real slow and humbly like, oh, yeah, she's right. It only did. It's like, okay, all right, everyone. Just back off. You're not our best guys.
Wow.
Here's old school movie yelling. Randy, I'm warning you now.
Oh, thank you so much for the warnings.
Because your headphones, I think, behave differently than the rest of us. So here you go.
Really
that skeleton beam must be what they use to wipe out the French city.
It neutralizes Maison somehow. They're the atomic glue holding matter together. Cut across their lines of magnetic force and any object will simply cease to exist.
Good Lord.
Yeah, from that point on, there was a lot of running, a lot of swimming through crowds trying to get to people and get to locations and places.
Yep.
It was very much a on the run kind of movie.
A lot of people running into each other and kind of giving each other that look
that
you do, like when you run into each other. Sorry, gotta go. Sorry.
Right.
That thing.
You know, the run on the banks that always happens in these movies.
The mayhem, right? The looting. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'll take $1,000. Money means nothing now.
Oh yeah, that's a trope.
Yeah.
What's that trope called?
It's called the
It's called money for nothing.
It's called money is not power.
Yeah.
When the
rich people all of a sudden.
Yeah, the plot turns the rich people into the same as everybody else. Yeah, like okay. Titanic. Remember in Titanic?
Or worse, yeah. It turns them into the weakest. Like it turns them into the ones that can't
because
buy their way out.
They
had
to fend for themselves.
Yeah.
Money was always the answer.
Yeah, exactly.
That was in The Dark Knight Rises.
There was a bit of that. Well, that was the whole idea. He was going to equalize everything, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Listen, Gotham, you'll not have your money anymore, is basically. I'll be Mad Max one day. All right, check this out. Terrible scream. I'm warning you now. Here you go.
Thank you again.
You really are into that.
Was that the priest getting zapped, right?
Might have been.
Yeah, that was much later.
Was that later? I don't remember who died. Who knows? It was such a cacophony of that later on. Here's the general man, okay? General man.
General man.
General man.
General man.
I just like how he says it.
General man.
Well, because his name is General Man, that's why.
Oh.
Right. Look just, at you, you know, General Man.
Like M-A-N-N.
Not an amazing man or
Right, just an average general man.
Yeah.
General man.
Who will save us?
General man.
All right, great. all right. 90% of what again?
I'd say our effective losses were nearly 60% men, 90% materiel.
Materiel?
Material.
Material.
Material damage. Collateral damage, if you will.
I hate the term material. I hate it. Mm-hmm. And he did it just the way I hate it. All right. I like this guy a lot.
It was Uncle Matthew who found me.
I liked him.
That was like my favorite. I had to go back and rewind that a couple of times.
That's pretty good.
It was Uncle Matthew who found me.
I liked him.
He was good, except for when he was dumb and stood in front of the alien.
I liked him. And then 2 seconds later, he donkey kicks his chair out from Ethan and passes himself to the window like a fly.
That was great.
Right.
That was great. I wish
like
that.
Like the fly. And let's not forget, he does really look like Jeff Goldblum.
Oh, yeah. Oh, big time. That's interesting. He kind of does look like Jeff Goldblum. But when he kicked that chair out, I thought, well, you didn't need to do that. And then he ran up to the window and plastered himself on it with his arms all splayed out. I thought, well, you don't need to do that either, buddy.
So dramatic.
Yeah, that was great. Okay. Always the bomb back. I don't know what this is. What's this?
There's only one thing that'll stop the Martians. We've held back because of the danger of radiation to civilians. Now there's no choice. The White House will confirm an order to use the atom bomb.
Oh, yeah. It always, I know what it was. It always comes down to that. We're just going to have to pull out the atom bomb in the
50s. This doesn't work. We're screwed.
Your answer to everything.
Yep. Well, I mean, it seemed like the answer to World War II, didn't it? Or at least the war in the Pacific. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's just how that became. There were a lot of freakouts like this.
Blood.
Stop it! That's hysterical.
What the hell is it all about? Because she had the thing had touched her or something. Maybe it touched her, so it left something wet and it was blood.
He was standing there.
You could have given me a warning on that one.
I'm sorry. I should have warned you on that one. But
that was actually the loudest of the three.
The one that I didn't warn you about is the one I got you with.
Right.
The lady or the alien hand coming up very slowly, touching her on the shoulder, and then sitting there for a good freaking 10 minutes. Like, those things are the slowest, crappiest aliens of all time. Mm-hmm.
But they have the same little suction cuppy fingers, though, as the new versions.
Well, that's true. I think that's a big thing in the book, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah.
They discussed some of the quickness by which they had to make some of these props and in the documentary that I was talking about where they go back and talk about the special effects. And some of that stuff was made like the night before. So I think some of that slowness was because they were afraid it was going to literally fall apart if they weren't careful with it.
I feel like I need to read the book just to see what an 1800s viewpoint of this is, because the adaptations go into atom bombs and Tom Cruise goes into, you know, super viruses and everybody goes into their whatevers and changes it to match the time. But I want to read this. I really feel like I should. I may do that.
You totally should read it.
Okay. I wonder if it's interesting or if it's real stupid. Like, the aliens had funny looking antennae and, you know.
I'll bet it holds up.
You think so? Mm-hmm. All right. I'm interested. So I'm going to check it out. Let's see. More religion. There's no screaming in this, Randy. You'll be fine. Some religion, though.
Bilderbeck has calculated how long we have got until Martians take over the entire world.
Oh, this is
if the A-bomb fails, that is, the Martians can conquer the Earth in 6 days.
the same number of days it took to create it.
Oh, that was the line, yeah.
Right. Right.
And then everybody stupid looks.
Like, especially the woman at the far end who grabs the arm of the other guy.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Here's a description of my favorite time.
Attention, please. 2 minutes to bomb time. Prepare to take shelter.
It's almost bomb time.
It's nearly bomb time, everyone.
If you don't have goggles, look away.
Gather around. It's bomb time.
4 minutes to bomb time. Definitely.
Everybody picnicking and woodstocking the whole thing out there while the A-bomb is getting, it's like, what, 2 miles away. I'm like, are you people stupid?
Yep. It's like, it's going off now. It's it. That's all. Everyone go home. That's all we've seen. All right, check this out.
What an amazing cast of extras, though, to stick on that side of that mountain all looking at it, though, right?
Oh, yeah.
Hundreds of people that they had doing that. And I was thinking, all right, maybe this is B-roll of something else. Like, maybe they got this footage for something else. No, I mean, they're reacting to it, and they show another shot where it's kind of closer up, and they're reacting to stuff.
They spent the money in 1953.
Yeah.
They did what they had to do to get the extras in. None of them black, however.
So they didn't do everything.
Needing extras.
They didn't bring down
no blacks, please.
Awkwardness,
no black extras, please. Final clip. This is just, I wrote, I wish more people talked like this. So here you go.
Washington issued orders. In event the A-bomb failed, evacuate all cities in danger of attack. They'll be moving on Los Angeles now. We'll establish a line and fight them all the way back to the mountains.
I really wish we had more people like that today.
Yeah.
I want to hear
Man
that.
Of action.
Yeah. It's pretty good.
Now that we've reached the end of the film, can we talk about this thing, this what saves us thing in movies?
Oh, sure. Yeah. This is the big thing about the movie that if you've never seen it, spoiler, this is what makes this movie special, if you ask me.
Well, the whole story. Oh, I don't know how the original book went, but the movies, all the adaptations, as far as I'm aware, don't they all go down the same path?
Yeah.
But it's also, it's a trope, right? Like in the M. Night Shyamalan film, Signs, right? He has to come up with a way that basically the planet can fight back against the aliens because the people are too frail and don't have an easy way to kill off the aliens.
In Signs, it was water, right?
Right. In Signs, when water touched them, they...
hate water.
I like Signs. I kind of do. I think Signs is all right.
I like it. I think it was one of his best.
His first three movies are his best movies. Right. Everything after that is meh. And this new one that's out now, The Visitor, is it? It's where you go to an old folks home and the old people are aliens or something. Whatever it is.
Cocoon 3.
So here's The Visit. Yes.
The Visit.
So I just want to get out the dynamics of this. So this thing, the Earth fighting back against the invaders itself, it has to be ubiquitous. It has to be everywhere. It has to be something that we wouldn't think in the first place was going to get them. Right?
Yeah.
I'm thinking teenagers with smartphones in the next one. Somehow.
Yeah. They'll text him to death. They'll Snapchat him back to his planet. That'd be pretty good. This will get remade. They always do. Someone's always making a War of the Worlds adaptation. And it's just a matter of time before we see another one. All right. Well, let's see for your clips. That means that we are now diving directly into this here thing right here, which I can't find because I don't know why. The film sack checklist includes the following. Used an old electric Simon game to make an alien's eye. Check. Should have sold hair products from this film to make extra money. Check. And Dunaway put a yelling goat at the end of this. Check.
Good. You found my Easter egg.
I did. At the very end of the... So what Brian did is he went to YouTube as a convenience to all of us, which was very appreciated, by the way. Took all 17 parts from YouTube and made it one MP4 file that we could all watch and not have to deal with that. It's especially good for me because I'm capturing clips and stuff on a PC. So that worked great. And at the very end, the credits end, and there's even some black space, and I'm just thinking, well, that's it. I'm about to exit this. And then the yelling goat at the end.
Yeah, the screaming goat. And I'd actually debated on, if I had a little more time, I would have done it. I debated on lowering all the level of the movie down slowly, so that you would keep trying to turn it up. And then at the very end, just blast that thing.
Blast the goat.
Yeah.
That would have been a pretty good trick.
Fantastic.
Trek stuff, Star Trek connections. There are a few, as you might imagine, given the era. William Meader, who played a PE official, played the role of Space Commander Representative Lindstrom in the Star Trek episode Court Martial. Reginald La Singh played military officer in this. In Star Trek, played Captain Chandra in the Star Trek episode Court Martial. Same thing. Joel Marsden, who was MP in the Jeep, played a crew chief in The Wrath of Khan. And let's see, David Sharp played a looter in this, in Enterprise. He was security crewman in the episode Day of the Dove. And then finally, Brian Haskin, who was the director of this, was associate producer of TOS's The Cage.
Oh.
So there's some good connections in there. All TOS stuff.
Interesting.
Except for the movie. And I guess that's still the original people. Anyway, soundtrack great. P for Pooh. I didn't like it. That was one of these old 50s ones where it's just trying to yank your emotions around. I didn't like it. Let's sum this thing up in 140 characters or less. Let's start with Randy.
War of the Worlds. Man has maximized his ability to destroy things, so the universe gives us something new to fight. Then we count on the locals from Mayberry. Goober!
Goober. I almost thought I saw Floyd for a second in one shot.
Wow, well, from last week, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Floyd's everywhere.
The enchilada stand.
Andy. I touch you in your swimsuit place, Andy.
We have hot dogs.
When's Opie coming over? We can. Come on,
Andy. I'd just like to point out Opie wasn't in the show I was referring to.
Okay. Dunaway.
The War of the Worlds, like a pair of hiked pants so high you're in danger of catching your nipples in your zipper.
Oh, my.
Bring it down a level, Doc.
Yeah, no doubt. Speaking of which, the name, War of the Worlds. It's not really that at all, is it? It's
basically the War of the Worlds.
Yeah, but we're warring against Mars.
Yeah, but not really. We're just defending ourselves. And then they lose because there's something about the planet, you know?
It's War of Mayberry, I'm telling you.
War of Mayberry. finally, Brian Ibbett.
War of the Worlds. It's like a sci-fi version of one of those reality show Find Me a House episodes. Looks like this house has black mold and the new residents are dead. See you next week.
That's the shortest episode of that we've ever seen.
Right.
Well, while you guys were doing all that, this was just handed to me. A little Foley paper right here just for this reason.
Yeah.
Alternate titles. First one they almost chose was How Big Is Your How Big Is Your Disintegrated Left Head Pile? Leftover Head Pile. Can't read. Or, finally, They Came From Leftover Junk and Copper Pipe. Those are your options. Email. I got an email here from Aaron Hoy. Aaron Hoy, it's a great name. Wrote and says, Howdy, Film Sack.
Ahoy, for short.
Yeah, Ahoy.
Ahoy.
He says, Howdy, Film Sack. I was flipping through the lovely Netflix archive and stumbled upon a movie called The Substitute, starring Tom Berenger and Mark Anthony. I figured it was right up your alley. Love the show and everything you do. P.S. Ibbett is the bomb. Cheers.
Oh, yes, he is. Aww.
Yeah, that was very nice.
Wait. Does he mean he's literally the bomb? I mean, are we to be concerned?
I destroy every episode with my parents.
Nah, you're like a clock in junior high. You're not really.
I thought the substitute had, who was the guy?
The guy. You know the guy who I'm talking
about. Jim Belushi?
No.
Yeah, that's what I thought, too.
Is that thinking, isn't there, maybe you're right, it's also called The Substitute, and it's a comedy.
Yeah.
Right, so are we talking about the thriller or are we talking about the
Well, we're talking, I mean, Tom. This guy's recommending the Tom. Yeah, so Tom Berenger.
After a botched mission in Cuba, mercenary Tom Berenger.
This certainly doesn't look right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mercenary, but then there's a picture of him as a teacher.
Yeah, yeah. This is it. No, he is a teacher. That's the whole point, is he is a substitute teacher in this school
mission.
Because in this Florida school, supposedly something's going to go down. And so he's pretending to be a substitute teacher, but really is going to shoot everybody and whatever.
Gotcha.
That turns out much better than the ones I usually watch, where it's like
turned out much better than the Jim Belushi ones.
I've seen that movie and it's actually a blast. There are two sequels to this film. One is called The Substitute 2: School Is Out.
And that's great.
That stars Treat Williams in the role. He took over. Berenger was like, I'm out, that's it. And then Substitute 3: Winner Takes All is also Treat Williams.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's actually called Substitute 3: Winner Takes All.
Yep. Yep. And it looks like it's reviewed as poorly as you'd think. Direct to DVD piece of shit, it looks like.
I like the Substitute 2 cover box looks exactly like the first one.
Yeah, it does, the same gray green.
That's right. It's just leaning forward. Yeah. The Jim Belushi movie, by the way, is The Principal. Oh, also stars Louis Gossett Jr., Ray Don Chong.
And is that a comedy?
No, it was like a violent school. It was like The Lean on Me, but a little bit more.
Oh yeah, look at that. A teacher is assigned to be the principal of a violence and crime ridden school.
Can I just say that I hate those movies. It's because there's been so many of them. It's white guy comes in, white girl, white
or white
guy
girl,
comes
right,
into,
Dangerous Minds,
right comes into inner city, and is the salvation. That those movies, I've just seen it too many times.
The good one is Stand and Deliver, because yes, the guy is actually of the people he's teaching. Like, he's not right. he's not some white guy coming in to save everybody.
The good one is Back to School with Rodney Dangerfield.
Well, that's a good point.
That's the good one.
That's the good one.
That is a good one. Plus, well, there's Oingo Boingo. Can't go wrong with that. Yeah.
Our education-based films, we're going to go with the Rodney Dangerfield.
And kind and Dax from Deep Space Nine.
Yeah. Yep.
Speaking of Deep Space Nine.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Really? Well, no, we're really talking about TNG here. But, yeah, speaking of Star Trek, next week's episode is a commentary episode. Why? One of us is traveling. When we do that, we do commentary episodes. It's a perfect combination. So when that happens, we're going to be doing the TNG Star Trek The Next Generation episode, Season 7, Episode 19, called... What's it called, Brian or Randy?
Genesis.
Wait, which one is that one?
Phil Collins and Peter Gabriel.
Phil Collins.
Mike Rutherford.
But Peter Gabriel's only there for the first third, and then...
Right, exactly. He leaves and...
no, it is it's the episode where everyone devolves to whatever their thing is. So, like, Deanna Troi becomes a fish. Riker becomes a caveman. It's awesome.
Oh, it's going to be great.
It's terrible, but great. Barkley becomes a bug. It's fantastic. So we're going to do a live commentary track of that. It is available on Netflix and other streaming services, so pretty much no excuse not to watch it live with us, or not to.
So why are we even telling you about it now?
I don't even know.
You'll watch it live with us next week.
Yeah, watch it next week. That's next week right here on FilmSack, and then we're back to the usual grind after that. Our website is filmsack.com. You can send your voicemails to 801-471-0462. Email us, filmsack@gmail.com. We're always happy to read those. We are at FilmSack on Twitter. Leave us a review on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever podcasts are found. That's going to do it for us, for me, for Brian, and for Randy.
Yeah.
We'll see you next time.
Make me some breakfast.
I don't give a shit.
Oh, wrong one.
Oh, that was awesome.
Wrong one. Here it is. The show is part of the Frog Pants Network. Get more at frogpants.com. Oh, it's just habit, because it's in the place I usually have another thing, and that was...
I don't give a shit.
It was right there.
That was amazing.